The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Dick Army.
Just 1 year ago, a relatively obscure congressman from North Dallas put forth a wacko tax reform plan that was dismissed by his colleagues as a non-starter, a joke, the hallucination of a fuzzy-headed college professor. It was called the flat tax. Today, or so it seems, everybody's jumping aboard the flat tax bandwagon. Every Republican you meet is aboard, and even some Democrats are climbing aboard. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt has proposed his own version, and even the White House has not closed the door on the idea. The stampede is becoming so thunderous that our speaker today has been emboldened to entitle a chapter in his new book, The Coming Flat Tax Boom. He is Dick Army, of Texas, leader of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. Today, he is introducing the 1995 version of the flat tax legislation he wrote last year. If enacted, it would replace the current progressive income tax system, consisting of multiple rates ranging from 15% for lower incomes to 39.6% for higher incomes, replace that system with a single tax rate of 17% after 3 years for taxpayers above certain income levels. Special allowances would knock some 20 million Americans off the tax rolls entirely. A family of four, for example, would pay no tax if it earned less than $33,300 in a given year. And best of all, perhaps, those onerous tax forms would be reduced to the size of a postcard. But lest you think utopia is on the horizon, the Army plan does exact a toll. Home mortgage interest no longer would be deductible, nor would charitable contributions, nor would taxes paid to state and local governments, to mention just a few of the political sacred cows that would be speared by the flat tax. Taking on sacred cows, however, is a familiar role for Representative Army. His 1988 base closure legislation broke a decade-long logjam in Congress, enabling the Pentagon to shut down hundreds of obsolete military facilities. Even Texas is now feeling the pain, hard. This year's base closing list includes Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio. Representative Army has also led a bipartisan commission 5 years ago, a bipartisan coalition, to eliminate outdated farm programs, another idea whose time seems to have arrived and whose impact will be felt in Texas. Agriculture, not oil, is that state's number one industry. Still, residents of Army's home district seem to like him. They sent him back to Congress last fall with 77% of the vote. Born in Candu, North Dakota, 55 years ago, Representative Army is, in fact, a college professor, if not fuzzy-headed, at least gray-haired. He was chairman of the University of North Texas Economics Department before entering politics. He has more degrees than the weather in Washington this summer. And he and his wife, Susan, have one child for each of the five tax brackets in the current tax code. Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome, please, for the father of the flat tax, Majority Leader Dick Army of Texas.
Thank you. Let me thank you for that nice introduction. I don't know what to comment on that, but I do think I do need to, if I can. The only problem I found with the introduction was a little bit problem of inflection. Chapter 9 of my book is the coming flat tax boom. Not the coming flat tax boom. It does matter, you know, how we say these things, but it is exciting. And I'm excited about what I'm seeing of the manner in which people embrace this idea. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll forgive me for being in such a cheerful mood this morning. But to paraphrase an old Ethel Merman song, everything's coming up flat tax. One of my rules of thumb is that whenever I find Dick Gephardt singing out of Dick Armey's hymnal, I know that something important is going on in the world. And it's not just Dick Gephardt. These days, it seems you can't swing a dead catfish in this town without hitting the author of a new flat tax plan, or at least a major tax overhaul. Clearly, the lessons of the contract with America are being heard loud and clear by the Washington establishment. The American people are clamoring for a dramatically different kind of government, one that's smaller, more open, and more accountable. And as I said in my new book, The Freedom Revolution, I believe the most enduring revolutions bring about the simplest reforms. The moment the polls closed on November 8, 1994, today's mindlessly complicated, growth-stifling tax code began to tumble toward the waste paper basket of history. And that's why my friend Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama and I are proud today to reintroduce the Freedom and Fairness Restoration Act, the flat tax. This legislation features a tax system so simple you could do your taxes on a postcard. A postcard. And it's so fair, it might just restore people's ability to trust the government. Wouldn't that be a nice change? Rather than tinkering, Senator Shelby and I scrapped the entire tax code, corporate and personal, and replace it with one flat rate that applies to all Americans and all income earned in America. We leave just one exception, a family allowance to ensure that every family has the first claim to its own income sufficient to support itself. A typical family of four must earn $33,300 before it owes a penny of federal income tax. Beyond that, everybody pays a flat 17% on all income. No deductions, no loopholes, no tax breaks, no tables, no schedules, no nothing. Each year you calculate your income, fill out a postcard-sized form like the one blown up on this chart, make out a check, and drop it in the mail. End of process. You're done with the IRS until next year. It's as simple as an income tax can get. If you have business income, the process is almost identical. Whether you're IBM or a mom-and-pop grocery store, you still fill out a postcard-sized form. Just subtract expenses from revenues and pay 17% on the remainder. That's it. Instead of taking 11 hours to do your taxes, as the average family does today, you could do it in 11 minutes. Or maybe less. Imagine the new world that would dawn. Gone will be today's 480 different tax forms, and the 280 forms that explain how to fill out the 480 forms. Whole armies of tax attorneys and lobbyists will be out looking for more productive work. And as for all those IRS agents and auditors, well, instead of harassing you, they'll be sitting silently at their desks like Maytag repairmen. They'll be feeling bored and, I suspect, just a little bit lonely. There is an important change from last year's bill. We've added a new provision that requires a 3/5 supermajority to raise the rate, add additional rates, create loopholes, or shrink the family allowance. We are absolutely determined that the flat tax stay flat. And I can tell you this idea is catching fire. You can feel it. The flat tax is in America's future. Why am I so confident? Well, for one thing, over the past year, I've received more than 5,000 intensely enthusiastic letters praising the bill. And in just the past month, I've received nearly that many messages over the internet. Yes, the flat tax has gone third wave, with its very own homepage on the World Wide Web. The address is army.flattax. From this mail, I can tell you there are four basic reasons why people like the flat tax. They know it's simple, it's honest, it's pro-growth, and it's fair. Four virtues that you do not find in the current tax code. First of all, as I said, it's incredibly simple. No longer will the American people be spending as much as 5.4 billion man-hours figuring their taxes each year, which incidentally is more man-hours than it takes to produce every car, truck, and van produced in America each year. By one estimate, this needless time and paperwork costs our economy a staggering $232 billion a year, more than the entire federal deficit. That's a potential savings of $900 each year for every man, woman, and child in America. Second, unlike today's tax code, the flat tax is honest. By sweeping away all the special interest loopholes, it shows us right up front how much big government is really costing us. And by eliminating the code's social engineering and economic tinkering, it shifts power from politicians to private citizens. It has the decency to know our ability and to respect that we are the best judge of our financial decisions. Third, the flat tax is incredibly pro-growth, planting the seeds for rapid rises in output and wages. Any professional economist worth his PhD will tell you the chief cause of stagnant wages is our nation's anemic savings rate. And the chief cause of our low savings rate is today's destructive policy of taxing savings twice, once when the dollar is earned, and then again when it produces a return. The flat tax wipes out this perverse bias, and it does it with a single bold stroke. As a result, savings will rise, the pool of capital will grow, workers will be better equipped and trained, and their output will expand, leading to bigger paychecks. But a higher savings rate is not enough. We also need greater rewards for work and risk-taking, the true engines of wealth creation. Instead of punishing entrepreneurship with steeply progressive tax rates, as we do today, the flat tax slashes the top rate from 40% to 17%. And this enables this nation to unfetter its would-be Thomas Edisons and Bill Gates to create the inventions and industries and high-paying jobs of tomorrow. Today, people rightly ask themselves why they should invent the proverbial better mousetrap. Excuse me. When the government is going to take away half of their earnings anyway. The flat tax would make such risk worthwhile, would be making America a magnet for foreign investment capital. As a result, you can see from this chart here, the income of the average American family of four would be approximately $4,300 higher in the year 2002 than it would be if we retained the current income tax system. Higher savings, more risk-taking, higher wages. The fourth and final reason people like the flat tax is also, in my view, the most politically powerful. It's fair. Let me tell you a quick story. I was walking out of a hotel in Dallas, Texas, one day where I gave a speech. And the fellow that parks the cars came up to me and he said, "Congressman, I love your flat tax. And the reason I love your flat tax is that it is fair. And it treats everybody the same." I think that gentleman revealed something very profound, something very American in his view of fairness. In America, we define fairness as treating everybody the same. Rich and poor, black or white, we're all equal. That's why liberals ought to love the flat tax. When you tax everyone at the same rate, the rich pay a lot more in taxes than the middle class or the poor. With three times the income, you pay three times the taxes. 10 times the income, 10 times the taxes, and so on. Now, if you ask me, that seems pretty fair. But even beyond that, by the traditional liberal definition, our flat tax plan is, quote, progressive as the code we had under President Kennedy. As this chart shows, thanks to the generous family allowance, even with a flat rate, a family making $33,300 a year would pay no federal income tax. A family making $50,000 would pay 6% of its total income in taxes, and a family making $200,000 would pay 14% of its income. This means about 20 million low-income Americans would be dropped from the tax rolls altogether. Look at this chart and tell me, what's not for a liberal to love? So there you have it, simplicity, honesty, growth, and fairness. Four reasons why people love the flat tax. But now allow me to take a few minutes to address the four most commonly heard concerns about our plan. The first concern comes from the class warfare crowd. Let me say that again. The first concern comes from the class warfare crowd. And I'm sad to say a few careless reporters who are asserting that the Army flat tax does not tax investment income. They say we're letting wealthy stockholders off the tax hook. This is completely untrue. Our plan taxes investment income at exactly the same rate as wages. What we don't do is tax it twice. Take a dollar of corporate generated earnings. Today it's taxed at the business level and then taxed again when it's paid out as a dividend. That's double taxation, which, as I've said earlier, depresses the savings rate. Our bill, by contrast, taxes every dollar of business-generated income at the business level once and only once. And it does so far more efficiently than today's system because it eliminates the need for taxpayers and business to keep billions of pieces of paper for reporting purposes. So let me repeat, under our plan, all income is taxed at the same 17% rate with no exceptions. To suggest or imply that we do not tax investment income is a misrepresentation of this plan. Second question of concern comes from people who ask, will eliminating the home mortgage interest deduction hurt the real estate industry? The answer is not as much as lower interest rates will help it. While our plan does end the interest deduction, it also ends the tax on interest earnings. As a result, nothing changes. Both borrowers and lenders are held harmless. What the homeowner loses in deductions, he gains in lower interest rates. And in fact, he comes out ahead on the deal because the flat tax ends the bias against savings, causing the capital pool to swell and driving interest rates down even further. That's good news for the housing industry. And frankly, homeowners are not as wedded to this supposedly sacred deduction as you might think. By a 3-to-1 margin in a recent poll, homeowners say they're willing to forego the mortgage deduction if that loss is offset by a reduction in their tax bill by a similar amount. And that's what our plan does. So I'm confident homeowners, home builders, realtors, and lenders will all support our approach, knowing they're not losing a tax break, they're gaining a new and better tax code and a bigger economy. And that leads me, ladies and gentlemen, to an observation. Ladies and gentlemen, the American dream is not just owning your own home. The American dream is getting your kids out of it. And I can tell you, I have just raised 5 children, and I know whereof I speak. What we really want is a high-growth, low-inflation economy with opportunities where our children can get out of school, get a good job, raise their own family, and be able to afford their own home. And the flat tax goes a long way to making that happen. The third major concern about our plan comes from some of our conservative friends who are worried charity will suffer without the charitable deduction. My guess is they won't even miss it. For one thing, almost half of all charitable contributions today are not even claimed as deductions. So ending the break would have no effect on that giving. But more tellingly, during the 1980s, the so-called decade of greed, charitable giving actually went up, even as the value of its tax break declined dramatically. Because President Reagan cut the top marginal rate from 70% to 28%, the deduction became far less valuable for tax purposes. And yet, total charitable giving doubled in the 80s. Religious contributions nearly tripled. Why? Because people had more money in their pockets, their taxes were lower, and their incomes higher. The American people responded to greater freedom and prosperity as they've always done, by opening their hearts and their wallets to their neighbors. And finally, the fourth major concern with the flat tax is that it will explode the deficit. Those who want to preserve the current complicated tax structure have been repeating an estimate of $200 billion a year like a mantra. Well, as Ronald Reagan used to say, the trouble with our opponents is not that they're ignorant. It's just that so much of what they know isn't so. I've said from the beginning that I want our proposal to be debated on its merits and not on the issue of revenue loss. I've designed it to provide a $40 billion tax cut paid for by spending cuts. I've asked the Joint Committee on Taxation to score our bill, and I'm confident that joint tax will find it to be deficit neutral. When it does, the red herring of revenue loss will be laid to rest for good. What then is the Freedom and Fairness Restoration Act? It's a tax plan so simple you could do your taxes on a postcard. But more than that, it's also a vision of what America can be again. It's a formula for rejuvenating our economy, freeing our entrepreneurial talent, and reviving stagnant family wages. It's a common sense plan for returning to a government that is simple, honest, and fair to all its citizens. And who knows, it might just restore people's ability to trust their government. And this is why I believe the flat tax is in America's future. Thank you.
Thank you. Now the hard part, the questions. What do you see as the timeline for tax reform? Are we really talking about 1997? And what do you think is the likelihood of a flat tax enactment?
First of all, I'm sure you're all aware we're already holding hearings in both the House and Senate on the whole question of tax reform. This, quite frankly, is earlier than I thought would be the case. My own view is that you should expect to see the flat tax passed into law sometimes in 97. Now, there's going to be a lot of water to go over the bridge. There'll be a lot of proposals that'll be looked at and so forth and so on. But I look at this crowd and I see these are America. This is America. And I know that you deserve the very best. And that's why I'm confident you'll get the flat tax sometime in 1997. And I am confident. And I thought it was funnier now.
Please compare your flat tax with what is called a consumption or sales tax, and the difference in their effects on the economy. And while you're in there, you might as well briefly explain the difference between your plan and the Gephardt plan. And which is better? I expect you think your plan is better, right?
I was kidding. Dick Gephardt is a great guy, by the way, and he's a really good sport. He puts up with me. And I was kidding Dick that he is so misguided, he thinks I'm misguided. He said, "That's funny, Army. I felt the same way about you." But we are good friends, as Bill Archer and I are good friends. We have competing ideas. There are differences, and of course, that's what the contest and the debate and the hearings and all the vote will finally be about. First of all, to begin with, the difference between the flat tax and the various iterations of sales tax is that the flat tax begins with the observation that all income, all taxes are paid by people and all taxes are paid out of income, and says from that point, let's be honest and let's make sure everybody can see what their tax bill is. The sales tax says we're going to tax consumption. Well, you consume out of income, there, so over you tax. But anyway, you levy it. It's where you levy it on purchases. My own view is that the sales tax, if it has any impact on the economy, is most likely to have a repressive impact on the economy. My own view is, as you study on the sales tax and more you realistically appraise all the promises of a national sales tax, that you're going to find the bloom will go off the rose. But I think it's a matter of walking through that. The biggest problem we have with the sales tax is that it is a conceptual framework, and we don't know how to make a side-by-side comparison because we don't have any real details. But I think one of the big questions you've got to ask is, what is the rate? How regressive will it be? How complicated will it be if you try to avoid regressivity by making rebates? Who will enforce it? Who will collect it? There are a lot of questions left open there. The difference between the my flat tax and what Congressman Gephardt calls a flat tax is that mine's flat. I have one rate. He has five. I think the impact of his tax on the economy, he has clearly decided that he would substitute a curious income redistributional concept of fairness and equality or equity for growth. As I view his tax, I think it'll have very little encouragement to economic growth. I think the Gephardt iteration of the tax reform is one that complies very well with the basic party line of liberal Democrats in America, that we must have the government to redistribute income through the tax code. And my own guess is that it'll find a very little degree of popularity. The great bet that we're making in this sense, and one that I think we ought to really enjoy this great debate that we'll see in America. America is searching for a definition of fairness that America will embrace. My flat tax says bets that America believes fairness is treating everybody the same. And his iteration says, I bet America believes fairness is treating different people differently. And that's what the outcome will be.
All right, well, we'll challenge you with a few questions about the flat tax. Will a flat tax on earned income simply generate a whole new breed of accountants and lawyers to figure ways to shift income away from the earned income category into other forms which will not be taxed, such as capital gains and corporate dividends and so on?
Well, if it does produce a new breed of such people that have as their purpose to figure out that, what we're going to have is a new breed of very frustrated people, because they're not going to be. First of all, the distinction between earned income and unearned income is a fiction. The flat tax captures every dollar's worth of income that is earned in America, whether you earn that dollar by providing your labor to the production process or earn that dollar by providing your capital to the production process. Every dollar's worth of income that is earned in America is captured by the flat tax and taxed one time by a 17% rate. So, the only way I could give you any other answer is to give you one that's fiction, because the distinction between earned and unearned is sufficient. I can promise you that if the current tax code is most grotesquely unfair for its failure to capture every dollar's worth of income earned in America in a tax code. This one does. Taxes one time. There is no income earned in America. First of all, there's no income in America that's not earned in America. And then secondly, none of that income escapes the flat tax.
Many of our questioners recall 1986. Let's go back to then. The trade-off then in the tax reform bill was lower rates you get. You give up deductions. Okay? Fine. Everybody agreed to that and passed the law. So what happens? After people gave up their deductions, then future presidents turned around and raised rates. What is to prevent that from happening again?
When I began to write the flat tax, I predicated my effort by studying past efforts and their failures. And of course, the 1986 tax bill is the best example of good intentions gone wrong. So first of all, you notice I made the clear point. I intend to stay flat. You've got to be stubborn about this. Don't even start this exception business, or you build a computer virus and you just destroy the whole program. Secondly, what we did was put in the two-third requirement, two-third vote requirement to raise it. Now, even with the two-third vote requirement, I think we got to deal with the fundamental fact of life. It is one of the saddest things that I know of in America, that no Congress can ever fully protect the American people from a subsequent Congress. I don't know what to do with that. So I'd like to see that, but I think we've done the best protection we can.
Just for purposes of clarification, then we'll go on. Are you saying that for income of $100,000, earned income, for example, the first $33,300 for a family of four will be exempt from taxes? Yes, that solves that problem for
earned income. And again, let me remind you, there's no such thing as anything other than earned income. I'm going to insist on this point until the people get it. I mean, there ain't no free income.
But you're right. All right, let me, several members raise a question about an assertion you made. First of all, let's refer to studies that show that homeowners would lose an estimated $1.7 trillion in value if a flat tax were enacted and mortgage interest deduction were eliminated. And your response was, well, whatever they lose in tax deduction, they would gain in lower interest rates. So, the question: how can you be sure interest rates would go down if the flat tax is enacted? For example, suppose the budget deficit expanded. Wouldn't interest rates go up?
Okay. First of all, there is a study that talks about how real estate values will crash. Let me, my favorite book on tax reform, Birnbaum and Murray, Showdown at Gucci Gulch. You gotta love a book with a title like that. Page 111, in a chapter entitled Right Rosty. It says, to help make this argument, Franks, who is a lobbyist for the American Land Development Association, may be here. Frank's called in Jesse Abraham, an economist with Data Resources Incorporated. And he said, what do you think you'll find? Frank's asked Abraham. First of all, I don't have a contract with you or a check from you. This is a direct quote. After Frank's ordered up a check and contract, Abraham inquired, what do you want us to find? Then Birnbaum and Murray go on to say, Data Resources was only one of a host of hired guns who made hay out of prepared studies on the supposedly disastrous effects of tax reform. Now, I don't want to single out Data Resources. I mean, you got Citizens for Tax Justice. The hardest thing to ever find in Washington, D.C., seriously, I've been talking this ever since I've been here. The hardest thing you can find in this town is an objective number. I mean, it's really hard. And quite frankly, if you tell me what your lobbying organization is, and if you tell me you're hiring an independent person to study something, I'll predict with you without even any more than that what the outcome of the study will be. Now, I, on the other hand, only use objective people. It strikes me that we have written the flat tax with the treatment of interest that is clear, and even DRI allows interest rates will go down into the flat tax. But we've written it with a clear understanding of the need for deficit neutrality. We get within $40 billion, and quite frankly, everybody agrees that we will pick up that with the lower interest rates. And I would argue this. A Congress that is smart enough and responsive enough and responsible enough to pass the flat tax is a Congress that is disciplined enough to not let the deficit get out of whack. So if, in fact, we replace this Congress with a subsequent Congress that wants to go back to the old ways of doing things, the flat tax wouldn't survive 5 minutes in that Congress anyway. So what you have to ask yourself is, can you have a Congress that will have the discipline to pass the flat tax and move forward with it? I have a very, the flat tax is such an enormous change that I am confident that only a Congress that has learned the hard lessons of public responsiveness and responsibility will have the discipline to pass it, and such a Congress will be too much cherished by the American people to ever be turned out of office. That's what I believe.
All right, several, I'm going to consolidate several specific ones into one question here. Will there be room for tax-exempt organizations under your flat tax plan? Will the flat tax apply to interest on municipal bonds? And would Social Security recipients pay 17% on their benefits?
Let me see. First of all, I always wonder, what is a tax-exempt organization? Well, first of all, it's an organization that is exempt from the requirement to pay taxes, though they will survive. Now, are you saying, will I be able to get a tax-exempt contribution to such an organization? The answer is no. But the organization can still do its good work without being burdened by the taxes. What were the other two questions there?
Social Security recipients and municipal bond interest.
Social Security will not be taxed under the flat tax. Is that correct? I may make sure I'm not making a mistake on that. So it's not taxed. That's income. See, I always try to remember the focus is to have a discipline and no double taxation. You make your contributions to Social Security in pre-tax dollars. You should not then pay taxes on your benefits. That's the principle that governs that. And finally,
municipal bond interest.
Nope. Same thing. Again, you take all of these things you find on an itemized deduction and look at the itemized deduction. Think of it, if you will, as a playing field for mischief-making by high-priced, powerful Washington lobbyists. You can't stop these people unless you take the field away. Just take away the field. And then you got no place for these folks to play. How many of you are here, I don't know. But you see, and then that's where the discipline, if you read Showdown at Gucci Gulch, you'll realize since the playing field was left in place, everybody got on the field, and they played through Gucci Gulch, and they tortured that poor Bill until it confessed to whatever it is they wanted. And it was really, quite frankly, a very unseemly process. What we say is you got to have the discipline to be flat and to stay flat. So, you know, they're just not there.
And there are several questions on the transition. How long would it take if a flat tax were enacted to put it fully into effect fully? And would there be a whole passel of transition rules that would be more burdensome than simplified?
Well, that's another good question, and that's another question that helps you understand the importance of the question if you read that wonderful book, Gucci Gulch. We believe the transition must be premeditated. Quite frankly, Nunn and Domenici, with their plan, have also clearly demonstrated their understanding of this need. We have a transition team that's working on that. We have plenty of time to work out all the details. My own view is that you could have the full and complete implementation of the flat tax for individuals almost instantaneously. For business, I think you may have to have a transition period that could last for some items, possibly even a couple of years. So where the big transition item for business would be the switch over from current depreciation schedules, et cetera, and so forth, to expensing capital under conditions where you don't end up with a big revenue loss in the early years. So that would be the biggest thing that would give you any extended time period in transition.
Surprise, surprise. We have questions on other subjects besides the flat tax. You once proposed eliminating farm subsidies. Have you revised or reversed your stand on this? And most specifically, since 1941, the U.S. has had a ridiculous peanut program. Can the 104th Congress finally get rid of it?
Well, my view on farm policy is apparently pretty well documented. But in case you missed it, you'll find some rather expressive language in my book, Freedom Revolution. It's always been my argument that what we had to do through a period of time was phase ourselves out of farm policies, and that you needed to do that by compressing them from the top with the broad-based programs, such things like loan rates, et cetera, and so forth, and then taking off the edge the most egregious programs. And so whittling down from the sides and compressing from the tops, eventually someday we will. But it's very, very important that we realize you cannot take a population of American people that have spent a lifetime working in a government-controlled environment and ask them to immediately overnight switch from that environment to an environment of freedom. The lessons of freedom are awfully hard to learn, and they're very scary. So this should be done gradually. Now, where the peanut program is concerned, my own view is that it is such an egregious affront to the fundamentals of freedom and dignity for a government to have the audacity to tell some person, you have the right to sell this product because we give you a card, and to tell another person you do not have that right, that it should, and I expect will, be eliminated.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.